bracing for a federal government shutdown, lawmakers studying help for public pensioners, plus school consolidation and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 29th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb said he's holding out hope that the federal government won't shut down as a funding deadline looms, but adds the state is still bracing for it. Holcomb says the state has been preparing for a shutdown and that government benefits such as SNAP, commonly called food stamps, can go about a month without disruption.
This is avoidable if cooler heads prevail.
A larger issue is the economic impact of a shutdown combined with the restart of student loan payments, combined with an auto worker strike that could soon reach Indiana. Holcomb says these issues are why the state is trying to diversify the companies and industries it attracts.
We think that that will help us weather any cycle that may be closer.
In the most immediate impact, there are more than 22,000 federal employees in Indiana that could lose their pay during a shutdown.
Is the economy at risk because of the potential government shutdown? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Jennifer Hollowell. John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, as you know, I pointed out to the governor and he added, it's not just the shutdown, it would be the shutdown on top of student loan repayments starting up, on top of the auto worker strike that is affecting more and more states. Should Hoosiers be worried?
Oh, I think they should. I think the government shutdown by itself, some commentators are indicating, could trigger a recession. I mean, you've got this terrorist group in the Republican Party holding the entire country at gunpoint. And I don't know what they're thinking. They weren't elected to shut down the entire government operation. They were elected to govern. And instead of doing that, they're spending their time on their agenda that they want to somehow find evidence somewhere, even if they have to make it up, for impeachment proceedings against President Biden. And in the meanwhile, they're letting the government shut down. I mean, you're going to have military people unpaid. You're going to have payments delayed on Social Security and all kinds of other things for this just because they want to score political points. They had an agreement that Kevin McCarthy brokered 5 months ago, and they can't even abide by it for a full year, much less it's impossible. And it really is concerning because I think it could affect the economy, which has been going just great lately, could come to a dead halt because of this.
How concerned should Hoosiers be about the economic fallout from all of the stuff that's going on right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is compounding. So I'm concerned about it. I mean, I'm still hopeful that we can get somewhere or that it'll be short-lived. I mean, I think there is some sense we've gone through this so many times now over the last, you know, several decades that I'm not sure that people view it the same way as they do. But for all the folks who that is your direct impact, they're not winners in that situation.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I hope we can get somewhere.
As we take this, in Friday afternoon, we don't know whether or not the government will shut down. So depending on when you watch this, it may have been averted, we hope. More likely, it seems like it hasn't been averted. But, John, we've talked about whether it's debt ceiling impasses or shutdowns. We've talked about it on the show before, and we often talk about it being a pox on everyone's house. Do you see that the same way here with this one, or is one side making the case that the other side is to blame a little better?
Well, if you look at recent history, and by that I mean what our collective memory, Republicans have usually been the reason that the government has shut down, and they have, much to their dismay and consternation, received ultimately most of the blame.
I think Karl Rove just said that on TV this week.
And so that's, if history's a guide, and I've kind of given up on history as a guide, sadly, but let's assume that would be the case here. One must assume, if you pay any attention at all, you would see that it is the holdouts on the Republican side of the aisle And not Republicans in the Senate, mind you. I mean, no. Mitch McConnell, who runs the Republican caucus in the Senate, is just as frustrated, I think, as probably Joe Biden is with certain factions and for elements who are, in fact, holding the U.S. House hostage and maybe the nation by virtue of that. So there probably will be repercussions. But will there be repercussions for the people who are the holdouts? No. Because they're in districts, it might be their more moderate.
Not necessarily. I mean, Ann, you talked about that they weren't elected to shut down the government. In some cases, looking at the campaigns they run, I think they were elected by their constituents to shut down the government.
We're still supposed to have majority rule, and there's still 20 of them.
And let's remember, what is the goal here? For some, you would think you take office to serve the electorate, you take an oath to the Constitution, and you try to advance our nation, improve it, its security, and the welfare and well-being of its population. I think for some people, that's not the measure. I mean, we're in this sort of pitch battle where you talk about tipping the economy into a recession. For some, that might be just what the doctor ordered, because then they can blame it on Joe Biden. See, we told you all along that this Bidenomics stuff was no good. And so I think we've lost fact. Some people, elected officials, have lost fact that of the notion that they're there to serve the public and our nation as a whole. And all they're doing is creating chaos and trying to dismantle and render chaos.
It looks increasingly like, in order to get a deal to avert this or to after it happens to end it, Democrats are going to have to come on board in the House, because it seems like there's enough Republicans who just are unwilling, barring some extreme measures that I don't think the Senate will ever agree to. And that would help Kevin McCarthy avert the shutdown or end it, but it also puts Kevin McCarthy in the crosshairs to lose the speakership. If you're Kevin McCarthy, are you in an impossible situation?
Yeah, and partly, you know, obviously because of the small margin that he has, and these every day there's a new thread about, you know, bringing the motion to vacate the speakership. I mean, at some point they just need to vote on that and be done with that, so that they can move past the threat and the speakership stuff and focus on how to keep this going. And I do think we need to remind them more. You know, we talk about TSA workers and military, you know, they're not going to get paid, but these lawmakers are.
Yeah.
And anyone who says they're going to refuse their pay, by law, they can't, so don't buy that, you know. So, I mean, yeah, I just think the next step is to get the speakership stuff out of the way. Otherwise,
If you're a Democrat in the House of Representatives and the speakership does come up for a vote, do you support Kevin McCarthy and keep him in the speakership?
Because I don't know what
at that point you probably have to.
You probably do, because I don't know how it could. I don't know how much worse it could get, but it could probably get worse. But I don't think he's there, because you know they've got the Senate bill. He could bring that down and get the Democratic votes to pass it, and he won't do it.
Yeah, well, there's still a day left or so, and so
we'll see.
Well, to your point about impossible position, really, he's been since what was it, 15? How many ballots?
Yeah,
15
yeah.
or 16 ballots. As soon as the ink was dry on it, on his on the vote that that ultimately get delivered to him, the speakership, I think he was in an untenable and ultimately impossible situation.
Tom, now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. This week's question: who's to blame if there's a federal government shutdown? Democrats, Republicans, or both parties? Last week, we asked you whether Todd Rokita should be disciplined by the Indiana Supreme Court. 93% of you say yes, 7% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. A legislative study committee took its first steps recently in examining a guaranteed yearly cost of living increase for public retirees. But lawmakers are still cagey on what, if anything, they'll do to help nearly 100,000 Hoosiers receiving public pension benefits. In almost every budget going back three decades, the state provided either a cost of living adjustment, or COLA, to monthly pension benefits, or it's given retirees a 13th check, an extra month's worth of benefits. It didn't do that this year, opting instead to study a permanent COLA of 0.5% per year. The Indiana Public Retirement System told legislators that would cost the state about $60 million a year. Study Committee Vice Chair Jeff Thompson acknowledges that's pretty small compared to the budget, which this year was more than $44 billion.
But do you want to commit to that long term? I want to think and talk to some folks, and we'll see.
Whatever lawmakers decide to do, committee chair Brian Buchanan says it seems unlikely help would come in 2024.
My understanding, traditionally, we haven't done adjustments like this in a non-budget year.
Still, both Buchanan and Thompson say they aren't taking options off the table at this point.
Jennifer Hollowell, with a $60 million price tag, why is this not a no-brainer?
Well, I think, you know, it did pass through the House this past session. It didn't get through the Senate. I think really the focus is coming up with the long-term plan, which the long-term, the COLA increase will be better for retirees than the 13th check. Like in 2 years, 4 years, they're going to end up being better off financially with that. So it's a function of let's get that in place. I think there are some House members who may try to do something in a short session, and the Pension Management Oversight Committee discussed this at their meeting in terms of the value of the long term. So I think we get there quickly, but it's part of the process.
Yeah, I mean, why is this not a no-brainer? By the end of March next year, when the session is over, will this have been a no-brainer?
I hope so. I mean, it's long overdue. How long ago did the federal government index Social Security to cost of living increases? I mean, these people are getting paid pittance now. I mean, if they retired 20 years ago, they're getting nothing, comparatively speaking. And it's well past time, where they didn't even get the 13th check, as minimal as that was last time. It is time to index this and to do it in the... I don't care whether it's a budget session. It has to be done.
To that end, budget writers really hate reopening the budget in a non-budget year. But the way that they have historically paid for the 13th check is money from the Hoosier Lottery every year. Well, the Hoosier Lottery is doing just fine. And even if their performance dipped, they'd still be doing more than enough to give them an extra $60 million a year. So you could make an argument you don't really even have to reopen the budget in order to pay for this.
Yeah, or they could just pass a law indexing it and put it effective for the next budget if you wanted to do it that way. So that's an example. I will say, I think it's obvious that there needs to be some additional money given to retirees. I have found over the years of 20-plus years of covering this a little bit ironic that sometimes, so for the longest time, the retirees wanted a 13th check. And then they would say, well, no, we want the COLA because the COLA is better in the long term,
right,
because
it
obviously compounds. Right. But then the first time they gave them a COLA, then a bunch of retirees complained that the 13th check is what they want. Because it depends where you're at in the retiree system, how each thing impacts you. So I do feel a little bit of stuck between a rock and a hard place on the COLA versus 13th check, but the index would take care of that.
We talked about this at the end of session when they didn't put it in the budget for the first time in like two or three decades.
Yeah.
And it was pretty shocking because this is the slam dunk for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is older Hoosiers are among the most reliable voting bloc of any, and that's not just in Indiana, across the country. Older Americans vote more.
And they pay attention to issues in a way that perhaps younger demographics don't.
So again, I get Jeff Thompson is not wanting to will prejudice what's going to end up happening. But are you a little surprised that none of them are like, oh, don't worry, we're going to do something here. We just have to figure out exactly what we're going to do and how we're going to do it.
Of course, it's not a court proceeding. It's not as if you have worried that you're going to taint the jury. I mean, this is an inherently political process where everybody
has an
agenda that usually is out front, you know, whether anybody wants to listen to your opinion or not, you're going to offer it. So I understand why budget writers, we've seen nobody wants continuing obligations. That's what we always hear. One time, that we can stomach that, but we don't. But you're right. I mean, as everyone has said here, when you're dealing with a constituency such as this, people who have served the state, worked hard.
For a long time.
They lived up to their end of the bargain, and their assumption because of historical precedent has been that they would get something.
For most of them, for not a lot of money. I mean,
no, right. That's right.
State
oh, yeah.
workers
I mean,
have historically been pretty
underpaid.
And so there's that. I've talked about the Ebenezer Scrooge sort of image that you could attach to some members of the General Assembly, where it does seem that, the frail, don't need that. The elderly, they're going to be gone soon anyway. The children, I'm not saying that that's the way a lot of people wake up and decide they're going to go to their budget committee meeting and craft a budget, but it gives that public impression. And yet there are other sweet hot spots where the money flows. If you were giving educational vouchers or educational vouchers, I'm trying to figure if these folks wanted to go, maybe
we
these kids wanted to go back to school for continuing education.
No, we just need to say that the COLA is needed for economic development reasons.
Right. Well, that's economic development reasons.
The checkbook is open.
Or so they can help with the tuition to a private school.
I can't guarantee anything that will happen with this in the 2024 session. What I can guarantee is it won't be more than a 0.5% increase, because the cost of that is $60 million. If you go up to just a 1% COLA, it becomes $1.8 billion, from $60 million to $1.8 billion a year. I don't think lawmakers are going to do that. Just call me crazy. All right, Indiana Republican gubernatorial candidate Eric Doden is pushing back against the Indiana Chamber of Commerce's recommendation for small rural schools to consolidate. The chamber recommendation is part of its new 2035 economic vision plan. It says more than half of Indiana school corporations have fewer than 2,000 students, which the chamber calls a key threshold for schools to be able to effectively operate and provide necessary courses to students. But Fort Wayne businessman Eric Doden calls school consolidation a death knell for those who live in small towns and rural communities. Doden has made small town revitalization a tentpole of his campaign for governor, and while he doesn't oppose school districts consolidating, he says doing so without consolidating schools themselves, which he opposes, is unlikely. John Schwanis, the idea of school consolidation is not a new one. Lawmakers tried to incentivize districts to consolidate a few years ago and basically got almost no one to bite. Is it ever going to happen?
It's a tough slog, because people care about their local schools in a way that they might be detached from the political process and not pay any attention to what goes on under the dome in Indianapolis, unless it's something that your school that you attended and your grandfather attended and your kids are going to attend is going to go away. Oh, we can't have that. So you'll have that sort of pushback.
I mean, even the fight on school nicknames.
There's certain things.
It's an attachment.
But
it's
hardly, as you pointed out, hardly a new issue. Let's look at the Kernan Shepherd or Shepherd Kernan. I don't remember who got first billing. Back in 2007, which was a result of a task force that then Governor Mitch Daniels had assembled. And they looked at a lot of smart people on that group, and they came up with 20-some, I believe, recommendations. And one of them was, there were all this sort of the third rail, the township government, and other things that people hang on to, with clenched fists. But and you look at the data. I went back and looked at it, some of it. The 54%, and I don't know if this has changed, probably has, but the argument still holds, 54% of all property tax revenue that was collected at the time of the analysis that was done for that report in 2007 was going to schools with districts with under 2,000. Population, and I know we're talking district versus school, but in other words, the smaller schools who may not be able to offer an educational array of services as much as a larger district because they simply don't have the resources are sucking a lot more resources out of the collective till. So there's an educational reason to do away with them. There's a fiscal reason to do away with it. But all of that disappears when you have people saying, keep my school.
Yeah, I just asked John, is it ever going to happen? Does it need to happen at some point?
Look, I definitely think we need to look at it. And I get it. I went to a small high school. We probably should have been consolidated in Ohio with the very nearby one. But some counties have done this well. Park County went through this a few years ago, and they've done it well. The fact is, we do need to look beyond the Friday night basketball team and the mascot name and the history and say, look, if there's 800 people in this school district, these students, I mean, we can't give them foreign language. We can't give them advanced
calculus
or items they need to fill the jobs that we are missing in this state.
Right.
And we've somehow got to get past the sentiment to see if the students are being served in these small areas.
Yeah, we just went through this whole debate this past session about, rethinking high school. But the idea being that we need to better align high school curriculum to what students need when they get out of high school, whether that is going to a four-year university to get a degree or going right into the workforce or getting a certificate so they can get the jobs that are in their communities. In light of that conversation particularly, does this school consolidation conversation need to be ramped up?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've said for years that Indiana is over-governed. I mean, then the idea that we have 1,000 townships and innumerable school districts and all is crazy for a state this size. It adds a layer of complexity, it adds cost, and it takes away the opportunity for those students to be competitive. I mean, that's the thing we ought to be looking at. It doesn't matter who their mascot is or how well their basketball team did if they can't get a job when they graduate or they can't get into the higher education opportunity that they want because they haven't taken the courses that are required. I mean, it is senseless. And the people like Eric
Doden,
thank you, are the battles that they're fighting are battles that have already been lost because of the migration from these rural communities to metropolitan areas. And he needs to accept that. I mean, I think it's great to get broadband and to do whatever you can do to revitalize those communities, but not at the expense of the next generation.
To that point, I mean, this fits. I mean, this isn't just Eric Doden grabbing for an issue. I mean, he obviously wants the attention, and that's fine. But this fits very much in the policy proposals he's been doing for a while, which is this whole idea of revitalizing small rural communities. Does opposing school consolidation help revitalize small rural communities?
Full disclosure, I'm on the team for Brad Chambers for governor. I think that when looking at this issue, I mean, there are a lot of challenges facing rural communities, which a lot of people are talking about and is a serious kind of matter for the next governor and the legislature to look at. On this, I don't think it can be a one-size-fits-all approach. I mean, it's certainly very unpopular for the state to force things like this. I went to a school that was consolidated long before I was there, and I could still tell you stories that, you know, my parents and all these folks talked about who got which color and which part of the mascot, et cetera. So, like, you know, these things are something you have to deal with. And a lot of places, like, that's part of their identity. Like, that school is a huge part of the identity. So, but what's most important is our kids learning and the kind of school you're at, do they have the resources and are they getting the kind of education that they need? And can we be creative? Can we come up with some other ways? So, sure, maybe incentivize it. Are there other creative ways that we can figure out how to get them the right programs to be successful?
The Indiana Supreme Court says state law bans corporate contributions to independent political action committees or super PACs, even as the state acknowledges such a ban would be unconstitutional. The state court was answering a question posed by a federal appeals court as part of an ongoing lawsuit. Super PACs are groups that spend money on political races without coordinating with candidates or political parties. And in 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that limiting corporate contributions to super PACs is unconstitutional. But that's exactly what Indiana Right to Life super PAC says Indiana law does. It wanted to accept a $10,000 contribution from a local media company, so it sued in federal court. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said to make a ruling, it wanted the Indiana Supreme Court to first weigh in on whether state law really does ban unlimited contributions to super PACs. And the state high court says it does. It says the law specifically lays out which groups corporations can give to and at what limits. And because super PACs aren't mentioned in the law, the court says corporations can't give anything to them. The court's opinion acknowledges that both sides expect the federal court to stop the state from enforcing the ban, even as the state has said all along it never would. Nikki Kelly, with the expectation that the federal courts will take care of this, do you expect much to change in Indiana elections and spending?
No. I mean, this law has not been enforced for years. That was freely known. Obviously, someone could in the future, but, you know, the federal courts are going to rightly say under previous rulings that this is unconstitutional. And I don't think we'll see anything different other than we'll have a piece of paper that says it's unconstitutional. Lawmakers might physically repeal it if they'd like, but that's about it.
I mean, with the Citizens United decision, there was a definite change in federal elections in this country. But do you see the same sort of impact now that everybody's sort of acknowledging that we can do this in Indiana? Even though there's never really been a reason, it seems like we couldn't.
Interesting discussion. I mean, there are a lot of things at play here. People trying to raise money.
And get legal fees like Jim Bob.
There's lots of issues here, but I don't think much will change because at this point, I mean, there are some courts that would still see precedent like Citizens United as something that needs to be enforced. Not every court might see precedent as a governing factor, but I presume most would.
All right, finally, Gannett and its USA Today network of newspapers is hiring reporters with very specific beats. The two positions will cover Taylor Swift and Beyonce, respectively. Nikki Kelly, I'm putting this to you. As our journalist on the panel, how should we feel about the state of journalism?
Look, I get that we have to give a mix of things people want versus what they need, and, you know, I know that people see that those stories are being clicked on. It's obviously a huge issue. But it's hard to see the number of reporters I've seen lose their jobs, get furloughed, take early retirement, who did really good accountability journalism. So I think there's a place for this. Full-time positions, probably not. I wish they could just hire some freelancers for a couple months. And
yeah, there's an argument that these positions will be revenue drivers.
Right.
But it doesn't look great in light of all of the other stuff that particularly a network like Gannett has done. All right. Well, you should read the Indiana Capital Chronicle.
There
you
go.
Of course, all the coverage here on Indiana
Public
Broadcasting.
We won't be covering Taylor Swift, though. Maybe an occasional gift.
All right. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.